Sometimes God uses a calamity to get our attention. Jonah's spiritual awakening followed a life-threatening crisis. He was thrown into a raging sea and swallowed by a great fish. Well, today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll explores how our most desperate moments can become our most sacred encounters with God. He's teaching from Jonah chapter 2. And whether you're running from God or simply struggling to connect with Him, today you'll discover why the belly of the fish became history's most unlikely prayer chapel, and what it means for your own spiritual journey.
The Apostle Paul has written whatever was written in earlier times was written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort from the Scriptures, might have hope. Paul wrote that in Romans chapter 15, verse 4, and in the writing of it, he had in mind the Old Testament. Whatever was written long ago was written for our learning today. There are many who see less emphasis or less significance, I should say, from the Scriptures in the Old Testament than those found in the New. However, the Bible makes it clear that God's Word is equally inspired of whatever was written in earlier times was written for our learning. We're going through the book of Jonah, trying to uncover his story anew and afresh in light of the world in which we live today. And we come to this second chapter in the story. And finally, Jonah connects the dots. And we find him for the first time, if you will, on his knees. Jonah is finally calling on God. He does it in a rather unusual prayer chapel, you would have to agree. And we will see it as we turn in our Bibles to the second chapter of Jonah. I want to read for you these 10 verses. Jonah chapter 2 begins, "Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from inside the fish. He said, I cried out to the Lord in my great trouble, and he answered me. I call to you from the land of the dead, and Lord, you heard me. You threw me into the ocean depths, and I sank down to the heart of the sea. The mighty waters engulfed me. I was buried beneath your wild and stormy winds and waves. Then I said, O Lord, you have driven me from your presence, yet I will look once more toward your holy temple. I sank beneath the waves, and the waters closed over me. Seaweed wrapped itself around my head. I sank down to the very roots of the mountains. I was imprisoned in the earth, whose gates locked shut forever. But you, O Lord my God, snatched me from the jaws of death. As my life was slipping away, I remembered the Lord, and my earnest prayer went out to you in your holy temple. Those who worship false gods turn their backs on all God's mercies. But I will offer sacrifices to you with songs of praise, and I will fulfill all my vows. For my salvation comes from the Lord alone. Then the Lord ordered the fish to spit Jonah out onto the beach."
You're listening to Insight for Living. To dig deeper into the story of Jonah on your own, be sure to purchase our Searching the Scriptures Bible Study Workbook by going to insight.org/offer. Chuck titled today's message, Finally, Jonah Connects the Dots.
Any near-death experience has a way of grabbing your attention. I'm told by those who have been there that in a moment of time, like a flash, your whole life passes in front of you. It's as if you are reliving it in an instant of time. Those who lived through what was for them at that moment, the fear of drowning, say before they have taken their last breath, they experience that sense of awareness of how brief life is and how real eternity seems. I almost drowned twice in my life. Once when I was just a little boy in a place called Mason Park, which is a public swimming pool. I was there and did a foolish thing. I'd watched the big boys as they'd gone off the high dive, and I momentarily forgot that I didn't swim that well. And when you land after jumping off the high dive, you still have to get to the side of the pool, which requires swimming. And I thought I would drown had it not been for a very alert lifeguard whom I believe, while watching in a busy pool, literally saved me from drowning. It happened to me later when I was a father and had one of our younger sons, really small son, riding on my shoulders. I was holding his feet, and we were at a lake, and it was a hot day, and it just seemed like the right time for us to wade into the lake, and I'm holding him, and he's having a great time pounding on my head and shoving his feet back and forth, and as we get a little deeper in the water, he wants to go a little deeper, and I forget that the bottom is not only muddy, but it is a sharp slope as the lake becomes very deep very soon. And I lose my footing and I realize I cannot let him go or he will fall, and certainly too young to swim. And I would be grabbing for him, and I'm now choking. I'm down up to here, and he's having the time of his life as he's kicking his legs back and forth. And had it not been for a small root from apparently a tree under the surface somehow that had grown out, I could get a toehold, and that one little root, I was able to grab enough of the surface to push toward the shore and to make it back. And I remember choking back the tears. I remember his saying, "Let's do that again, Daddy." He thought it was a top-notch ride, and I was so grateful to have made it to the shore. In a moment similar to that, I was a Marine on a troop ship going from San Diego to Yokohama, ultimately to the island of Okinawa. We were in that 17-day voyage. We hit a storm at sea, which I've mentioned to you before. But toward the end of the storm, we were back in our guard duty, and one of the young Marines, somehow on guard duty on the deck, fell overboard. We didn't know how. We only know that because he didn't report back in, he was overboard. And through most of that night, we searched and searched. There were lights all around the Pacific as it was still churning, and we never found him. I'll never forget standing guard duty the next night and reading the ship's log, the ominous three words following his name, lost at sea. What a treacherous thought. Fully clothed, no doubt still holding his rifle, perhaps screaming at the top of his voice, and we never could find him. I read more recently, wicked men and women may be found among sailors, but when they are lost at sea, none is ever an atheist. There is no atheist lost at sea. You long for God. You call on God. You scream for help, hoping for rescue. There is nothing like a raging sea to acquaint you with a God you have chosen to deny. Perhaps the psalmist had some of this in mind when he wrote in the 107th Psalm, verses 23 and 24, "Those who go down to the sea in ships have seen the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep." It's amazing what being at sea, especially a rough, deep sea, will do to your prayer life. It's amazing. Speaking of prayer, I have chosen to begin by underscoring several things about it that we tend to forget. Four come to mind. First, prayer is always appropriate. There isn't a right time to pray or a wrong time. There isn't a better time to pray. It's always appropriate. There isn't a right or wrong place to pray. Any question that starts with, "Should I pray?" is to be answered yes, followed by the word now. Should I pray? Yes, now. It's always appropriate. Second, prayer is always a priority. That's why the Apostle Paul begins in his letter to Timothy, chapter 2, "Pray first. Pray first." It fits before any action is taken or any decision is to be made. Prayer fits the beginning or the ending of any experience. You never regret it when you pray first. The reason is it engages you with the Lord. It links the two of you inseparably together. Prayer is always a priority. Third, prayer is always beneficial. It clears your mind of the mental and emotional debris that's gathered through the day. It clears any situation of worrisome clutter that plagues you and complicates the situation. Prayer is needed to provide insight and discernment that we don't have. It seems to come automatically when we bow the knee. It's amazing how that cuts through the garbage of life and clarifies things. Prayer is beneficial. Fourthly, prayer is always reassuring. It reminds us we're not alone. It results in our being less fearful. As boldness replaces weakness and reluctance, it provides inner strength and a quiet sense of confidence. And have you noticed prayer always prompts a spirit, an attitude of gratitude? It's almost impossible to finish time with the Lord without a thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for this, for that, for these things. So when we get to the second chapter and we begin with that long-awaited word, then Jonah prayed. Then, finally. He hasn't prayed until now. We first met him in chapter 1. He wasn't praying in any part of that. When God said, "Go to Nineveh," he responded with such words as would imply, "In your face, God." He didn't pray about that response. When he made his way to Joppa, he didn't pray about what would happen at Joppa. When he looked for a ship that might be sailing from the shore, he didn't pray about which ship. When he bought the one-way ticket, he didn't pray before he bought the ticket. You read nothing of prayer. We've been waiting for this preacher to respond willingly and obediently to his Lord, but he's done the antithesis. Not going there, God. There's no way. And even when he is on that ship and awakened in the middle of that dreadful storm that's beginning to rip that little ship apart, he doesn't pray. He doesn't even say to the sailors, "We need to pray." He is willfully disconnected from his God. And this is an appropriate place for me to tell you something, lest you forget it. Even a preacher can live a prayerless life. We can operate in the flesh worse than the worst. We can make big decisions and carry out big plans and talk a big fight and that night sleep like a baby, all the while faking it, acting as though God is in it when we haven't once engaged him in prayer. Sometime it takes being thrown into a stormy sea to shake a preacher awake. We can be so stubborn. Example, Jonah. Then, finally, Jonah prayed. It took all of those things I've named that we've read about in chapter 1 to bring him to his knees. I left out one. As he is thrown into the sea, fully clothed, as the cold waters of the Mediterranean submerge him, and he now is on his way, plunging to the bottom with the seaweed wrapped around his head, along comes a fish, large enough to swallow him, that rescues him, having been sent there by God. The Lutheran theologian Theodore Leitch, in his work titled The Minor Prophets, writes this: a Christian cannot come into a place so abnormal that he or she could not pray to God there. We cannot imagine a place more horrible, more filthy than the one where Jonah was, in the belly of a horrible monster in a dreadful sea, all alone, cast away from mankind. Yet Jonah prayed there a model prayer. The belly of this sea monster was the prayer chapel from which ascended a prayer pleasing to God, accepted and answered by him in a truly marvelous manner. Close quote. In application of this clear realization, let me add, we're free to pray anywhere. Think about it. He prayed from in a fish. You can pray in a crushed car, half full of river water, after a terrible collision, and it's appropriate. Call out to God. You can pray while you're sitting in solitary confinement in a dangerous prison, any prison on earth, and your prayer will be heard. You can pray on your bed in the middle of the night, submerged in depression, with thoughts of suicide, and your prayer is heard, because he neither slumbers nor sleeps. You can pray on a deserted island thousands of miles away from what you would call home. You can pray for finding something to eat, finding fresh water to drink, finding shelter from the elements, encountering some way to be rescued, you pray, you pray, you pray. It's appropriate. You can pray from a tiny hiding place with the boots of the soldiers heard nearby. And those prayers are effective. You can pray in a plane that's having engine trouble and it's halfway across the ocean, or perhaps the dark of night flying over a mountainous area. You pray, you pray. You can pray before your oral exam, having finished your degree work, let's say a PhD, and you're sitting out there about to face these scholars who will be interviewing you, you pray. I hardly need to tell you that. Prayer is the most natural thing in the world. I have a friend who took his work in an area where only Dutch was spoken. He was an English-speaking person, but all of it was taken in Dutch. And he said, written on the walls of the room where he was waiting, just before he was interviewed for that final oral exam, there were these prayers written in the Dutch language all around the room. You pray in an outside office before you were interviewed for a job. You pray anywhere, anywhere, and our God hears you. I remember speaking at Moody Bible Institute several years ago, and we took a little break between the speakers, and while having coffee, a lady walked up with, she had just a delightful sense of humor. She was so cheerful and a middle-aged lady, and as we were talking, she said, you know, when I was a student here, I was single, and I longed to be married someday, but I didn't want to marry the wrong man. And she said, I was in the dilemma between really wanting a husband someday, but never wanting the wrong man. So I realized my only recourse was God. And so I wrote out a simple prayer, she said. These are her words. Her prayer was, Father in heaven, hear my prayer and grant it if you can. I've hung a pair of trousers here. Please fill them with a man. She gave me that prayer. She said, here it is. And I thought it was terrific. She, matter of fact, she said, in a very few years, I met that man. And in 10 years' time, we've had 8 children. I thought, you really did get married. Well, that's terrific. Well, it was such a great story when I got back to the church I was serving at the time. It was in California. I shared that story. It did not fit the sermon, but you know, preachers, we'll jam it in if it seems like a good moment, and I did. Interesting, in the congregation that day were a father and a son in a family of 4. The mother and the daughter were missing because the daughter was sick that Sunday and the mother was home with her, but the father was there and an older son. In his early 20s, and everybody around the room was laughing, just like you did, but he didn't. The son was kind of tilted his head, and I just happened to glance at him, and life went on. A week or so later, I got a note that was sent to me, and it was from the mother in this family. She said, I want to know, Chuck, if I have something to be concerned about. For the last couple of days, our son has hung a bikini over the foot of his bed. What's this all about? So I just say to you, mothers, prayer is appropriate. There's something a whole lot worse than being unhappily single, and that's to be miserably married. You don't want to rush into that. You certainly don't want to act in a passion of the moment. And I will tell you, great mates are rare. Look carefully. Pray hard. Think for a long time, because marriage is made for a lifetime.
A another practical insight from our study of Jonah, the reluctant prophet. There's much more application coming from our Bible teacher, Chuck Swindoll, so stay with us. Here at Insight for Living, we provide a number of resources to help you dig deeper into the Bible on your own. First, we have an in-depth workbook on this 9-part series on Jonah. It will definitely prompt some meaningful conversation in your Bible study group. This Searching the Scriptures Bible study for Jonah will allow each member of the group to engage in this dynamic story and its relevance for today. This spiral-bound Bible study workbook contains all 9 studies that accompany Chuck's sermons, with plenty of room to take personal notes along the way. To purchase the Searching the Scriptures Bible study for Jonah, call us at 800-772-8888 or go to insight.org/offer. Second, did you know that Chuck Swindoll offers a daily devotional sent directly to your email address? It's absolutely free. These brief devotional emails from Chuck are among the most popular resources that Insight for Living offers. To subscribe, go to insight.org/devotional. Finally, today we're saying thanks for your financial support by providing a brand new booklet from Chuck. It's called Look Beyond, Will You Focus on Eternity? This booklet features the final sermon Chuck delivered on the weekend of his 90th birthday at the church he founded and loved. Chuck cited the powerful counsel that Paul offered to his young protege, Timothy, to brace himself for the storms coming, but never lose sight of the rewards of eternity. That's the enduring application in Chuck Swindoll's booklet, Look Beyond. We'd love to send you a copy today with our thanks for your financial support of Insight for Living. To send a donation in the mail, write to us at Insight for Living, Post Office Box 5000, Frisco, Texas, 75034. That's Post Office Box 5000, Frisco, Texas, 75034. You can also call us at 800-772-8888 or give online at insight.org/donate. I'm Bill Meyer. Join us when Chuck Swindoll continues to tell the story of Jonah's about-face, Tuesday on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, finally, Jonah Connects the Dots, was copyrighted in 2018, 2019, and 2025, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2025 by Charles R. Swindoll Incorporated. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.